They weren't sure what the brain problem was. They thought it was an infection. But he was going downhill fast, had stopped breathing a couple of times. And because they thought it was an infection, one of the first things they do is they do a lumbar puncture. As they did the lumbar puncture and started to withdraw the spinal fluid, he was going to die. His breathing was stopping, his heart was slowing down, he was going to die.
Welcome to Unexpected Turns with myself, Anne Dibben. You never know who you're going to meet. Recently, I was stuck at a bus stop in Lymington and got talking to today's guest, Clive Denham, whose life has had more than a few unexpected turns, not least of which is working himself up to become a millionaire and then ending up homeless. But nothing has stopped him having a huge zest for life. Like Richard Branson, he's in his early 70s and ready for the next adventure. Listen on to hear his story. Thank you for meeting me today, Clive, after our meeting.
Meeting at a bus stop.
In Lymington. And now here we are today in David Lloyd and having a quick catch-up.
Indeed. And I'm happy. I think this is a lovely idea and I'm really looking forward to it, as I hope your audience will be.
Definitely. Well, it's not often that you get captured by somebody in a bus stop in Lymington, but you were so fascinating and you had so much to say, I just really felt all of our audience needed to know a bit more about you. So if you could just tell us a bit about yourself and your background and the unexpected turns in your life.
I can honestly say that's the first time the word fascinating has been applied to anywhere near me. But that's wonderful, thank you. Look, I like interesting people as well, and I make it my purpose to meet people. If they don't want to talk, they don't want to talk. But it surprises me always the number of people that you meet. Everybody has stories, and a lot of people have really interesting stories in different lives. So it was great to meet you, and I understand that you're interested for this podcast in life events as such. And I'm going to paint a picture of two, and I hope they're interesting. Let me set a scene. We go back to 2005. I am 56 years old at that stage. Where am I? I am very happily married. I have four children. Great kids, just great kids. We had four children in the space of 6 years, so
wow.
they are a little bunch, and they've always stayed together as a bunch. They get on really well with each other, and they were great kids. Great kids that we hauled around the world at least twice before there was entertainment on planes, and they were just... They've always been a delight, and they still are a delight, and they still spend an awful lot of time with each other. So we're just a family. We had a business of our own working together, my wife and I, after my corporate career. And my wife had then branched out into house development. It was something she'd always wanted to do. She'd always built onto our houses and modernised things. And she loved doing that. So she's then decided to do it as a sort of part-time business. Started off small with just a terrace house, and then ended up building a couple of houses. But we got to the stage where the house that we were in, we had always wanted to move about half a mile away to a beautiful road. This is near Ascot in Berkshire.
Lovely area.
It is a lovely area, and this one road in particular, Locks Ride, was the place to live. The houses down there were very different, quite old, most of them. And there were sometimes small bungalows on large plots of land. And she came to me one day and she said, "We're going to buy this bungalow." But not, "Would you like to have a look at this?"
But we are.
She wasn't that kind. She just came and said, "We are doing this." "Fine, let's do this. If that's what you want to do, let's do it." And the plan was to buy this bungalow, knock it down, and build a substantial house on the site, which we were going to basically design ourselves and bring in an architect. She already had a tame builder called Andy who had built two or three houses for her with a very small team. A good guy in terms of getting things done on time, getting things done on budget. But
that doesn't go together with builders, budget and on time.
No, I laugh then because my wife, but my wife had a tremendous set of skills. She was incredibly good with relationships. She was hugely good at parties and entertaining and things like that. She could sell anything to anybody. She really could. But the one skill she didn't have of any way, shape or form was money. She was utterly hopeless with money. That's fine. That's fine when you're a trainee nurse and then you become a nurse and all this kind of thing. But our life was moving on. So in 2005, we looked at this house we were going to build. We projected to build it, finish it for around about £400,000. And our expectation was we'd have about a £300,000 mortgage, which for our finances at the time was absolutely fine. So although Sarah was going to manage the project from start to finish, because that was part of her forte, I in the background would handle all the money and do all the contract work and everything else. So I reached a position where we had employed a sort of design and build contractor to do a lot of the work in terms of delivery of everything that Andy needed to build it. And so basically of the build cost, probably 80% of that was locked down under contract, you know, with a sort of 5% either way. Fine. We start the build goes superbly well. I have to say this house was beautifully designed. We designed it and it was beautifully laid out. It was done in brick and flint with a slate roof. It looked great. When you walked inside it, it was great. Every bit of it was. And we'd included underfloor heating and things like that. And oh, by the way, the house already had a swimming pool in the garden.
Oh, gosh.
And a sauna, which my teenage children thought was just absolutely magnificent. But that's another story. Suffice it to say, we get pretty much towards the end of this build. And I'm just not involved because Sarah's handling it with Andy and everything else. Until I opened a letter one day. It was a letter from the Halifax, which was our building society at the time, and where we'd borrowed money to do the actual build. And my expectation, having done all the figures, was that we would end up, I think I'd already said, with a mortgage around about £300,000, which we could afford. Imagine my delight when I get down, sort of halfway down this letter from the Halifax, and it shows my current mortgage is £800,000.
Good grief.
I think that's just a typo, or it's just an accounting mistake. It was not a mistake. This was in the days, and okay, I stand responsible for some of this. This was in the days where they were giving mortgage money away.
Yeah.
It was, you could tell anybody how much your earnings were and everything else, although our earnings were good. Anyway, the key to this was that if you wanted to change your mortgage, if you wanted to borrow some more money, you only needed one signature. And so Sarah, bless her, had been taking more money from the Halifax without even telling me. And so what do you do when you get this letter and you've already rung the Halifax? They've said, no, this is it.
Accurate.
This is how it got there. Your wife comes home one day and you make a cup of coffee and you sit down and you say, quick read of this letter. Well, true to herself, she didn't flinch, and she didn't try to explain, so I had to dig and dig and dig, and she never actually told me even at that stage, what had gone wrong or how it had got to that number. These were things I had to discover over the next, I don't know, several weeks. And as much as I could discover, she had her housing development had gone wrong, not in the house that we were building, but in other ones that she was doing at the time, to the extent that she was building two houses in a local town. That had got problems. She was being sued by some building company that they said she had used their plans without addressing that and paying them for it and all these sort of things. There were sort of several areas which were just completely unknown to me where this money had been going. So what are we going to do? You just go forward, right? And I said to Sarah, look, I've never walked away from a bill in my life, a debt. I never would do that. We will find a way of settling this. And it turned out that it wasn't just the mortgage. It turned out that she had three other bank accounts, which I didn't know about. And, well, long story short, the total number that she owed was close on £1.5 million.
And this is 20 years ago?
This is 20 years ago.
Almost.
Yes, almost, yeah, almost.
Lot of money.
A lot of money. Yeah, I mean, we were very lucky. We had a good business. We were doing very well. But when I sat down and did the figures, to pay everybody back was almost everything that we had,
yeah.
In terms of pensions, in terms of savings, in terms of investments, and sell the cars and everything else, it was almost exactly the same number. But I said to her, look, we're going to do this. Right? The worst case scenario is, A, we have to give up this house and that will hurt. We just go and rent somewhere. We've got enough money coming through the business to go and rent somewhere. And we will pay everybody off. And that's what we did. We paid everybody off. We went out, rented a place. Life goes on, right? I hadn't realised how much it had affected Sarah. I have to say, it didn't affect me much at all. I've never been a money person, right? I've just never been that. It doesn't bother me one way or the other. Or I have it, or I don't have it.
As long as you've got a roof over your head.
Yeah, you've got a roof over your head and you're happy and you're healthy and your kids are healthy. That's the end of the game.
Exactly.
And that was exactly where we were. But what I now understand from Sarah, and certainly talking to her friends downstream, she was hit very hard by the decline in status that we had. And again, did I ever think about status? No. Right? But we lived in Ascot, which is a pretty high-class area. We had a lot of friends who had substantially more money than we did. We moved in circles of dinner and parties at Nick Faldo's house. Just an example. And Sarah couldn't abide that loss of status.
Did your friends still remain your friends, though, or did you start to lose your friends?
No, you start to split them. And I have to say, most of our friends were Sarah's, because for the simple reason, she was so damn good at making friends,
yeah.
And people always wanted to be... I'm a tag-along, I'm the support act, and that's fine. I know my limitations, and that's fine. So they were almost invariably Sarah's friends. All of my friends are very long-term buddies who I've known for 30, 40, 50 years. The sad bit is they all live around different parts of the world. None of them lived locally. So I didn't have any support at the time, but that's by the by. I think in retrospect what Sarah did was looked at this whole situation and thought, there's no way forward here. There's no reasonably quick way back to where we were, let alone moving beyond that point. And I think she just did a quick calculation and thought, there's plenty of guys out there who have got millions that we know who are single.
Right.
And she was a very attractive, fun woman.
Mm. Interesting.
I never put that to her. I believe that to be the case. Where did we actually get to? We got to a point where we'd already decided the business that we had, I could take to Australia. We had friends and family in Australia, and I've always liked being in Australia. So the idea was, for a quick rebuild, she would stay here in the UK with the kids and keep the business going. I would go to Australia and I'd build the same business again out there, and we'd have another income stream. Fine. I spend about 18 months going backwards and forwards every 6 weeks to Australia. That's fine. I like travel. Love travel.
A lot of travel.
I love travel. But anyway, we were in a restaurant one night and I said something about Australia that I made it clear that I thought we should all go there, and I could see her face across the table. That ain't gonna happen. That is not going to happen. Not many weeks after that, I was in a bar which our friends owned, and we would spend a lot of time there. It was basically a champagne bar. I don't even drink, so, but anyway, by the by. It's one of those men's experiences. You're in the gents' loo, right? You're standing at the urinal with your bit in your hand, and your friend Mark is standing next to you, who's a good friend. And Mark said, I'm sorry to hear you and Sarah splitting up.
And you'd no idea?
No. And you think, first thing, don't wee down your trousers, right? That's not going to help anybody. But talk about a shock. I had no idea at all. Right? So I let the evening finish. We went back home and I spoke to her. I didn't confront her, I spoke to her. And I said, look, this is what Mark said. And she said, I'd like you to leave. Another shock. Another shock. I mean, we were getting on really well. Okay, there was tension because of the rebuild and everything else, but... And I said, why? She said, because you're so unhappy. And I thought, no, I'm not. I've got things to think about, but I'm not unhappy. Mm. I've never been unhappy. I'm not an unhappy person. And that was literally all that she would say. After that point, she would not talk to me. She just wouldn't.
So you were both living in the house and she wouldn't talk to you?
No. So... I think I remained in the house for weeks or so while we talked to the kids and we got the kids adjusted to it. And then I left. And when I left, let's go back to the finances. At this point, I think we had £45,000 left in the world. I took five, which got me a plane tickets to Australia, because I thought, I'm just going to go and do what we had intended to do. I'm going to go to Australia for a while and rebuild a business out there.
Because you've been going backwards and forwards.
I've been going backwards and forwards to Australia anyway. So that's what I decided to do. I thought, we'll let the distance work for a while and just see what happens. And it was fine. I would fly backwards and forwards and we'd be a family again for a while. I mean, Sarah and I were not together as man and wife anymore, but you know, we worked well as a family. We weren't rowing or anything else like that. And I'm in Australia and I'm having a wonderful time. I love Australia. I'm a sailor. I do all sorts of water sports. I'm in heaven. I'm building a business and it's going very well.
Good.
I've got a huge government of $1 million... Australian dollar government grant. I'm on a university campus where they've given me space. All sorts of good things are happening. The best of which is I'm a sailor. And I was about to achieve a lifelong ambition of buying my boat and living on my boat on the Swan River near the Central Business District.
Delightful.
This is great. I'm a week away from handing the money over with this boat. And I get a phone call. A phone call from my daughter, and she said, Dad, she said, you need to get home now. Excuse me if I get emotional now. One of our sons was probably not going to last the night. He had a brain problem. They weren't sure what the brain problem was. They thought it was an infection. But he was going downhill fast, as in he had stopped breathing a couple of times. And I will always forgive Sarah for anything she ever did, because as that process started with Owen getting ill, she kept him alive. She's a nurse. She realized that this was not a headache, this was not a migraine, this was something worse, and she got him to hospital very quickly. Because they thought it was an infection, one of the first things they do is they do a lumbar puncture, and they look at the bacteria in the spinal fluid. And she insisted on being there. They said, no, you've got to be out. No, you don't argue with Sarah. She is staying with Owen while this procedure happens. And thank God that she did, because as they did the lumbar puncture and started to withdraw the spinal fluid, he started to, he was going to die. His breathing was stopping, his heart was slowing down, he was going to die. And what they didn't realize, and Sarah didn't, at least she realized he was in real danger, so she stopped the lumbar puncture, and she fought them, and they had to pull this needle out the end, or she was going to do it. And what it turned out was that the infection that he had was in his cerebellum. The cerebellum is at the bottom of your brain stem, top of your spinal fluid. And what they've done is you withdraw fluid in the spinal column, you reduce the pressure, and it literally pulled his cerebellum down into the top of his spine. The cerebellum controls all your basic, functions, motors and functions. So his heart was about to stop, he's about to stop breathing. So at that point she saved his life. And for me, that's it. I would forgive her anything from this point onwards, right? She saved our son. I get back on a plane within hours, and I come back, and it took us 6 months to put him back together. This is despite the fact that he was in St. Thomas's Hospital in London, one of the best hospitals in the country.
Yeah.
And when we got there, the consultant said to us, look, almost 90% of everybody who comes in here doesn't come out. They go to the undertakers, 90%. He said of the other 10%, he said most of them are severely damaged for the rest of their lives. And he showed us the scans, and your cerebellum is kind of big tomato, small grapefruit size. And he showed us this white patch, and this white patch in Owen's brain was dead tissue. This dead tissue was more than a golf ball. And he said, this is his cerebellum, this is all his motor, this is his life preservation, his breathing, his heart rate. This is all his motor skills. He said, if he survives this, the chances are he will never move, talk, ever again. Right? He'll be alive, but he will be effectively a vegetable. He's your son, you move forward. Even moving forward was difficult, because as he began to recover's not really quite the right word. I was with him one day, sitting at his bedside, after he got out of intensive care, which he was in for.
So he was conscious now?
Yeah, they put him in a deep coma.
Yeah.
And one of the highlights that we had, of all the nurses that he had, constant nursing, there was one who was exceptionally good. And I remember her saying to us, you can take a bit of comfort here, because we know which patients are fighting for life. Although they're in a deep, deep coma, we know which ones are fighting. She said, Owen is fighting.
Wow.
Fighting to stay alive. Oh, sorry.
Now you've got me crying too.
Yeah.
We'll take a sip
of
that coffee.
Yes, that's probably, sorry, coffee break. I do apologise.
Not at all.
Let's cut this long story short. 6 weeks after he goes in, expecting to die or come out a vegetable, he walked out with us. and the patients and the, you know, the nurses and the doctors and the consultants are just stunned. And in fact, he ended up going back to the hospital to do a complete review with them as a special case that they'd never seen before.
So he was like 1/1000th of a percent.
It was 1/1000th of a percent. And when he came back out, we were watching his motor skills come back. I mean, he could walk, he could do most things, but his fine motor skills were not there. I remember the joyous day. At some point, I taught all my children how to juggle, which is a great skill to have if you want to be good at parties and things like that. And I remember seeing Owen in the garden starting to try to juggle again. And within minutes, he could juggle 3 balls again. And it's just, it was transformative.
And this is with this dead golf ball sized part of his cerebellum.
And the cerebellum can regrow a little bit, but it's very unusual. And to that extent, I mean, this consultant has seen these things thousands of times, and he said, look, that's it, that's gone. So he made a remarkable recovery. He made an absolutely remarkable recovery. But by the time we had got him back together, Simon and I had tried to get back together, and it kind of didn't work. And I knew it didn't work for the same reason that I thought it was the problem years ago. As in, we got to the stage where, before the whole financial thing happens, we got to the stage where we've got 4 teenage children, the eldest of which is kind of 18, maybe 19. I had this conversation with her one day, sitting over a cup of coffee. So now they're starting to fledge, or they're just about to start to fledge. What's the plan, right? We'd always had a plan to go to Australia. What's the plan? Where are we going to go to Australia? We're going to move somewhere else? We're going to downsize? You know, what do you think we'll do? Looked like this blank look on her face. Just totally blank look on her face. So I rephrased the question. I thought she just not understood the question. I rephrased it, and she looked at me and she said, no. She said, we're staying here in the big house, right? And I thought, I could, at that moment, I could see my life going out in front of me. I could see the rest of my days being, she followed it up with, because we've got a swimming pool and a big house, I mean, we had 7 bedrooms and 14 toilets and shower rooms and all sorts of things. She said, so then all the kids can come here with their kids, and you know, and it'll be great because they'll love being here. I love my kids. I adore my kids. I've always loved my grandchildren as they come along. But I could see my life laid out in front of me. It was garden maintenance, gardening and house maintenance, things like that. And I am not fit for that. That is not going to work for me. It's going to work hugely for Sarah as matriarch of her family. It's not going to work for me. And I kind of knew at that point we were destined not to be together for throughout our age, you know, our older years. So I think I then, at this point, I've decided that it's not going to work. It's kind of beginning to work for the family, but it can't work for me long term.
So that was the conversation you'd had before you initially split up and lost
the
money.
That was a conversation I had while we were living in the big house.
That's right.
With the swimming pool and all the things. That was the conversation we had.
So you had an idea that you weren't going to stay together then.
Yes.
And then you did separate.
Yeah.
And then after Owen's
miraculous recovery, yeah.
You then had the conversation again?
Yeah, I was mowing the lawn when I made this decision. And I made the decision not just for me, but for the family, because we'd restabilised everything in the family. The finances were okay, because the business was okay. I knew I could leave her with the business. So I just went back in and I said, look, I'm really sorry, but I have to go. And I basically packed a suitcase, cuddled my kids, left within about 20 minutes. Yeah. How did we get to this point? Why did we get to this point?
Gosh.
Yeah, the thing, you know, the unexpected that happened.
Definitely.
Right? So there was that, what was that? That was two unexpected things, the 800,000 pounds, or 1.5
million.
1.5 million,
which you recovered
right,
from.
Which you recovered from. Well, we paid off all the debt. We paid off all the debt. And owed. And the loss of my business and everything else in Australia, and I swear I'm going to send Owen the bill one day. Just for fun.
Just for fun.
Just for fun. I'm going to
it was worth it.
It was worth it. And now you look back, okay, there's a sad part to this story. So this was 2008, 9 now? Yeah, about 2009. When Sarah and I finally split, we remained good friends. Ever since then, we would, you know, meet together as the family and all the rest of it. We remained good friends. Sadly, she died in 2019. She got a very virulent skin cancer and died. So, in some respects, I'm sorry to talk about her when she cannot defend herself. But trust me, there wasn't a defence. I've looked long and hard. There wasn't a defence.
Oh, but she, as you say, she's the result that Owain survived.
Oh, absolutely. And therefore I forgive her absolutely everything she ever did or ever could have done that I still don't know about. That's the most important thing you could ever do. And in her own, if I can make her own defence, I talked about the loss of status, you know, amongst our friends and the area that we lived in. That was also a factor with her and her father. She was incredibly close to her father, and her father had really big expectations of Sarah. And he was delighted to see her building her life and then building her own business. And you know, and I knew that part of this, a large part of this, was she could not face her father with what she'd ended up doing. But we all make mistakes.
I mean, it's difficult to lose status in your parents' eyes, isn't it?
Yes.
Anyone else, it doesn't matter.
Exactly that.
But your parents,
exactly
is,
that.
It's difficult.
Exactly that. Yeah. So, yeah, that's that kind of the story.
But you're very, I mean, you're very happy you've moved on. You, as a family, you're very close-knit.
Oh, for my part, I couldn't be happier because I moved just far enough away from my children. I love them, but I'm not going to live their lives, right? I'm an hour and 20 minutes away from most of them. Fine. You want me to come and look after the dog or whatever?
Yeah.
I'm there. Just plan it, right? But I moved down to the south coast because I'm a sailor.
Yeah.
I've always been a sailor, and now I can go back to sailing. So we get to the stage where everything's happy and going well. And again, if I look at what happened to Sarah after we finally split, she was happy.
Good.
She was happy. She never made any money. She even got a job, and she still was overspending absolutely everything she was getting. Oh, by the way. So Sarah was happy. I was happy. The kids were happy. But the kids would ring me up every once in a while and say, "Dad, she won't leave us alone. She's on the phone all day. She's around." It's like, because she wanted to be the matriarch, right? And my kids didn't really understand the concept of being a matriarch. They have their own families by this stage. But anyway, yes. Was it a good thing in the end? Did it work out for really for the best? Absolutely it did. And as I said, very sadly, she died very unexpectedly. Children and grandchildren, myself, all devastated. So yeah, that was another unexpected life event as well.
Mm.
Okay, so that's the story of my family as it was.
Yeah.
Where do we get to? We get to 2018. lots has happened. I've now, at that stage, I think I have 10 grandchildren, maybe 11. I'm a man. I can't count beyond 4 grandchildren. Why would I get anywhere near the right number? But it's a lot, and it's still not finished. They're growing. You know, they're growing more babies as fast as they can. Anyway, I'm at home one day, and the postman comes, and I open. I don't get much mail. I have a quiet life. I open this letter, and I read this letter. It's from a tracing agency. Fine. This tracing agency is trying to find about Denmans, which is my surname, and particularly Denmans who have any association with Australia, which I have. I have family there. I have a sister who's lived there for 40 years. I know another couple of Denmans there as well, which came through sort of looking for family histories. Let me digress for just a minute, because even that was interesting and unexpected. Because what did I find out? I found out while I was living in Perth, I found a load of Denmans in the area who, when you trace it all back, had been transported for life.
Gosh.
For theft and other sort of minor irritations.
Convicts,
of the
yeah.
law. Yes, convicts and all transported for life. And I met and contacted a couple of people, and I'm still in contact with them. But then I was with my sister, who was north west of Sydney on the coast, a place called Newcastle. And I did some research out there.
I've been to Newcastle.
Okay. Well, she's actually in a place called Toronto, which is just a few miles further down the lake. But so I started doing some research there in the local archives, and I was particularly interested to find a Denman Island. Sorry, I need to go back again. While I've been on my own, I've always loved travel. I love travel. When the internet gets beyond just started and becomes a really useful tool, one day I looked up everywhere in the world called Denman, and there aren't that many places. So I made a plan to go and visit them all, and I've wandered around the world at various times to some really obscure places. I mean, just way out in the boonies, as they say in Australia. And I actually got it down to three at the time that we're talking about. When I find this Denman Island up in the Whitsundays, up the top end of Queensland.
Yeah.
So I'm going to go up there.
Definitely.
And I did go up there, and it's part of the National Marine Park, and you are only allowed to stay there. It's a tiny little island. It's 100 metres by 200 metres, something like that. And it's conical. It's got quite a really steep bit in the middle. You're only allowed to stay there for one night, two people, one night, one tent, in this little scrape that's the only place you're allowed to pitch your tent. But I've never been one for rules, so I booked 7 nights in a row under 6 different names, and my name was the last one on the list. Great. So I'm out on this little tiny little coral island for 7 days. It's just wonderful, loving it. And luckily, when the marine police turned up to check licenses, which they do very often around that part of the world, it happened to be the last day of my stay there. And whose name was on the license? My name was on
you
the
were
license.
Lucky.
I was dead lucky. And they thought this was great. This is a Denman on Denman Island. They're ringing around telling everybody. But that was good. That was good. But what came out of that was I was trying to find out how Denman Island got its name. And what I did discover, took me a long time to confirm it, was that another part of my ancestry, other than the convicts who were over in Perth, one of my ancestors had been Governor General of the whole of Australia.
Right.
Yes. He is part of the baronetcy. There is a baronetcy of Denman in the Nottingham area.
Yeah.
And that's where my father's family hail from. Right? So yes, this chap becomes Governor General in 1910, somewhere around about there.
So he wasn't one of the
convicts. He was a knighted baronet at the time, and he was a very senior army officer, which is why he got recalled for the First World War. He got recalled, but his wife stayed there, and she did an awful lot of charity work. So in the sort of the Sydney area and around that sort of part of the world, there are plenty of Denman roads and Denman parks and all sorts of things. So that's just a digression. It's just a digression while I was in Australia. But we come back to this email I get from this tracing agency. So again, I know quite
a
lot.
Can I just stop a second?
Of course. Back to this this letter that I've got from the tracing agent, which is looking for Denmans and contacts in Australia. So I write a screed and I send it back to them, and a couple of weeks go by and then I get another letter. And now it's a letter about Denmans in the UK. And I had a brother, two sisters, sister living in the UK. I go through all that. And then I go back. A couple of weeks after that, I get another letter, and this letter is about people who might have lived in the Berkshire area. So there's a series of letters, and they're getting closer and closer. I'm not writing letters anymore. So I rang this agency up one day and spoke to this woman, and I said, look, this is getting closer and closer. Now, I take your original letter that says she's looking for wider family. I said, is she looking for her parents by any chance? This woman said yes. I said, am I in line to be Father of the Year? She said yes.
Wow.
I said, how close am I to be Father of the Year? She said, well, let me explain what we know so far. Right. And the story starts to unfold. This girl was born in Australia, in Sydney, in 1972, and I'm thinking, where's the connection? It turns out her name is Suzanne. She was born in 1972. She was born to an unmarried mother who put her up for adoption as soon as she was born. And so what Suzanne knows, she's adopted by an Australian couple. She knows she's been adopted. As soon as she's old enough to understand, they tell her, and they have an expectation that one day she's going to start looking for her natural parents. She finds her mother's birth certificate through the orphanage. And in Australia then, you did not have to identify the father.
Right.
You only had to have the mother's name. That was all.
I think it was like that here as well.
It may well have been. So Suzanne sets out to find her mother. Australia then is a federal system, so statewide records. There's no online records kept and everything else. So she spends years dealing with these things remotely and not finding her mother. She eventually gets around to thinking of, I wonder if my mother went back to the UK, which is exactly what had happened. Her mother had gone back to the UK pretty much after Suzanne was born.
Right.
Long time passes, Suzanne marries, has a daughter, and then her husband gets moved to the UK. Suzanne by this time is a scientist in her own right. She's a biochemist and a biologist and all sorts of good things. Her husband is a remarkable guy. He's one of the leading people in the world on particular things that happen in the brain and cognition. So he gets moved to a very... he gets moved to a research centre which he runs in London. So they move over to London. And so now Suzanne starts again to look for her mother. By now we have a lot of online records. Doesn't take her long to find her mother. By this time her mother is living, I think, in the Birmingham area. So she gets in touch again through a tracing agency. There's no direct contact. She eventually meets her mother, and they they have an interesting relationship. Unfortunately, her mother never told anybody, ever, anywhere, that she'd had a child.
Baby, yeah.
So her mother had come back to the UK, married, still married, had two daughters of her own, but this is not known to anybody. So although Suzanne and her mother have a relationship, it's emails and the odd text and phone calls and things like that, not much beyond that.
And the rest of her family, the rest of her mother's family, know nothing about Suzanne.
Nothing.
So Suzanne's mother's family, they know nothing about Suzanne, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. And I believe that's going to be the case ongoing. Okay, so having positioned Suzanne all this, let's go back to the to my position with this tracing agency. So I ring this woman up and I say, you know, am I up for Father of the Year? Yes. She said, let me explain what we know. And she then proceeded to say, we know who the mother is. The mother has said, this is who the father is. Not this is who the father may be. This is who the father is, right? This is his job. This is his name. This is his full name. These are his family members. This is where he lives. It's like everything about me.
Oh, my goodness.
So I said, look, fine. I've never walked away from a responsibility. It would help. Could you tell me this lady's, the mother's name? She said, yes, I can. And she told me this name. And I thought, that name means nothing to me. And we're going back to when I was 21 years old.
Mm.
And I tended to have longer-term girlfriends rather than short ones. I had a few very, very short ones, but not that many. And I thought that, and my memory's not that bad. And this name meant nothing to me. So I said to this woman, look, I'm sorry, but that name really doesn't register with me at all. So I said, look, I'm actually going for a long walk this afternoon in the forest, and I'll have a good think about this, and if anything gels, I'll come back to you. You do what you need to do, and anything comes up, I'm walking through this forest reviewing my life when I'm 21 years old, and I'm working in international computers, and I remembered this conversation with this girl that I had not known for only more than a couple of weeks. And I remember the words. It went, there's no point in you and I becoming serious because you're about to get on a boat with your family and emigrate to Australia.
Mm.
And I thought, oh my goodness,
oh gosh,
there's the Australian connection. Right? And it turned out, yes, when she got on this boat with her parents, she didn't know, but she was carrying our child.
And how old was she?
19.
1971. And so she didn't tell her parents?
She didn't tell her parents. She went to Australia. She made some excuse to her parents. I think she basically said, I think they were going to Melbourne to live. And she said she'd got a job in Sydney. So before they discover that she's pregnant, she moves to Sydney, she stays in Sydney, she has her baby, Suzanne, and she has Suzanne adopted straight away. And I think after that, she only stayed in Australia for maybe a year or two before she came back to the UK.
Cool.
So I said, well, of all the information you've got, that kind of pretty much nails it down to me, doesn't it? I said, what do we do from here? And she said, well, look, it's interesting that you don't recognise the name, but we're going to go ahead on the assumption that as the mother said, this is the father.
Yeah, right?
There's really,
no question.
There's really
this
no
is the
questions
father.
About that. Let's proceed on that basis. So on that basis, they put me in touch with Suzanne. And we exchanged emails. And I think then we had a phone call. And when she got on the phone, she sounded like my sister in Australia.
gosh.
And when she laughed, her laugh was exactly the same as my sister in Australia. I thought, amazing. This is bizarre. This is just bizarre.
Definitely.
So we chatted and we agreed to meet. And she worked up in London. And I have a fast train from where I live up to London. So we agreed to meet under the clock at Waterloo Station.
As you do.
And I said, look, just look for the old guy with white hair who's pretty confused, right? That'll be me. So anyway, when my train pulled in, she was already there under the clock. There weren't that many other people of her age, because if I do my calculations right, she would have been 46, something like that.
Right.
Yeah, somewhere around about that. Anyway, we recognised each other. And I just said to her, is it too late or too early for a hug? And she said, nah, come here. So we just had a great big hug.
Oh, how wonderful.
And then we went off for a cup of coffee and sat and chatted for an hour. And what did we do other than we had a laugh. We had a laugh about the whole bizarre situation.
And so you found an instant connection.
I'm sorry. Sadly for her, I could see me in her. And the more we talked, there is so much of me in Suzanne. There just is. And she knows it, and everybody else knows it. There is no doubt. Despite the fact that because she's a scientist and I have a family, we said early on, look, we kind of know that I'm your father, but we're going to do a DNA test, aren't we? Which we did, and of course it came back like 100%. So yeah, it was a wonderful meeting. We could have both been axe murderers. We could have both been heroin junkies.
Yeah.
Who knows?
No idea.
There's just genetics linking you together, right? But the more we talked, just on that first meeting, the more we realised how connected we were. One of the key things was we talked about her mother. Because I said to Suzanne quite early on, I've been given the name of your mother, but it doesn't gel
sense,
with me.
Yeah.
And she said, no, because at the time, her mother, who I now call Jeanette, because that's the name I knew her by, I think she had a stepfather. Whatever it was, she didn't like Jeanette as her Christian name, so she used her middle name in the office, and she used her father's surname. So what went on the birth certificate was totally different from what I knew her as.
The name you knew, yeah.
The name I knew her as. So, yes, it was a wonderful surprise. It was a wonderful surprise.
And that was in 2018.
This is in 2018.
Yeah.
So now we face I've got to tell my family about this, right? Mm. And I thought, I know my kids, they'll be all right with this. The only problem I had was, do I tell them individually? Do I tell them as a group? And so I got in touch with Sarah, my other kids. Because people ask me now how many kids I've got and I just get confused, right?
Yeah.
Like four from over there and one from over here somewhere. Anyway, so I rang Sarah and I met Sarah in 82. And so this was 10 years after I'd met Sarah that Suzanne is conceived. And she
10
took
years
it...
before you met
sorry,
Sarah.
Sorry, 10 years before I met Sarah, yes.
Yeah.
So there's not an issue there. Sarah didn't take it particularly well, but the question to her was, should I tell the kids as a group or as individuals? She said, you tell them as individuals. And it was... You think you know your children. Everybody thinks you know your children.
Yeah.
You think they know how to react. But once they're in a group, they may react differently. Right? So she said, no, you tell them individually. And preferably, if you can get to them, you tell them all on the same day. Because one of the first things they're going to do, because they're
it's
really close
now,
is they're
going
to ring each other up. So I went in age order, Morgan and then Bethan and then Owen and then Jan. And I briefly explained what it was, and to an individual, they all burst out laughing. They just went, "Oh, Dad, it's always you, isn't it? There's always something, right?"
It just seemed like that from what we said.
Well, yes. So, anyway, they were just amused by the whole thing. And then when it came down to it, I said, "Look, I'd like to introduce Suzanne to you all." And Bethan at the time had the biggest house with the biggest garden, and it was summertime, so we said, "Look, we'll get a barbecue. She'll come down with her husband." And that's what happened. And from that moment on, we have been a blended family. They used to see Suzanne very often when she was in London. She's now moved to Peterborough, which is kind of, you don't just, you know,
no, you
run down for the afternoon
there,
for, from Peterborough. But no, they, you know, we see each other as much as we can. And just everybody gets on like a house on fire. So
wow. She it's amazing,
is,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is amazing. I would love to have met or even spoken to her mother, but she's declined that. And I can understand that, but from my point of view, I just wanted to meet Jeanette to say sorry. There was nothing I could do. I didn't know she was pregnant.
Yeah.
And to be pregnant at 19 is bad enough. Right?
And back then as well.
Back then is bad enough. In Australia, you make it worse.
Mm.
But, you know, they're kind of... culturally and emotionally, they were certainly then a long way behind us, right? So she must have had a terrible time. And again, I would just like to have seen her to apologise. But then you think through along that line and you think, where were we before she emigrated to Australia? I'm 21, she's 19, I have a good job that pays a lot of money. I think I've been brought up pretty well with a good moral compass. I have no doubt we would have married.
Yeah.
I have no doubt we would have married. We might have waited a while, but I've no doubt that marriage was on the cards. And then you look forward from that point. You think, then I never meet Sarah. The four children I have already don't exist.
Yeah.
None of my grandchildren exist. You think... how bizarre does life get if you kind of do this going backwards thing and project from there? So no, has it worked out well? It's worked out remarkably well. And then as you get to know each other and you get to talk more, you find out other... This is where it gets just ridiculously bizarre. My sister has lived in the Newcastle area for 30-odd years. Two or three places, Toronto and a couple of other things. It turns out that Suzanne is brought up by this lovely Australian couple with two sons, I think it was already. They wanted a daughter, hence Suzanne. They lived, Suzanne, for the first 16 years, before she went to university, for the 17, 18 years of her life, lived 20 minutes down the road from my sister.
Gosh, what a coincidence.
20 minutes down the road from my sister. Suzanne went to the same school as my sister's two daughters. And in fact, we're pretty certain that Suzanne was in the same year group and the same classroom as my sister's eldest daughter.
Cool.
It's just beyond that. And then Suzanne married, has a child called Alice. My other daughter, Bethan, has three children, two girls. The second girl is called Alice. And these Alices share the same birthday.
Really? Same
name and they share the same birthday.
You just can't believe the coincidence.
I know, you just can't make this thing up. You couldn't write it this way.
And they've all met each other and they all get on well.
They all get on well. Yeah. It's just lovely. I mean, I've often thought my life can't get any better. I do. I think about that almost every day. My life can't get any better. And I've thought that for a very long, despite the bad that, despite things that happen, that's just life. Life happens, you deal with it. I've always been amazed at my life and how good my life has been by comparison to so many others.
Mm.
And yet all of a sudden it just takes another massive leap forward in really, really good. Got another daughter, another granddaughter.
Quite something.
It is. It is quite something.
Cool. Well, it's been quite some adventure.
Well, I don't think the adventure's actually finished yet, because I say to my men friends, right, my daughter took 40 years to turn up. I said, you never know.
You never know.
My kids are waiting in expectation that another one turns up and think, oh, please don't. That would be awful.
Wow.
So that's my story. That's my story. My story so far, I think, is what I should say.
I like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anne.
Huge thanks to Clive. In fact, I was so absorbed listening to his stories, I didn't even hear all the hubris in the background until I played this back. So huge thanks to him, and thanks to you, all our amazing listeners. We hope you're thriving. And like Clive, looking forward to the next adventure. Until next time, take care.